dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Today and for the next several weeks, we're going to bring you sound from an amazing forum on biotechnology entitled Big Money, Bad Science that took place on November 10th in Vancouver, Canada. We strongly urge you to tape this broadcast and to pass tapes to everyone you know. If you can't tape, you can also download this program from the Unwelcome Guests website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. The issues discussed are critical for anyone who grows food, eats food, uses medicines, or cares about their children's and grandchildren's health and future. A bill is before the New York State Legislature that would place a 5-year moratorium on the planting of genetically modified organisms. Our access to organic food and an uncontaminated environment are at stake, and we have the possibility to stop the biotech blitzkrieg while strengthening our local tradition of family farms. We encourage you to send a tape of this panel to your state representatives and senators. The biotech industry has pulled out all the stops to kill this legislation and has initiated a $50 million disinformation campaign. Our program today will help you see beyond the lies and the hype. Many of the speakers address issues with a Canadian perspective, and one can see how remarkably similar their problems and issues are to those facing Americans. Tonight's panelists are author Maud Barlow, chairperson of the NGO The Council of Canadians, who is an expert on the anti-democratic impact of international trade agreements. Dr. Anne Clark, associate professor in plant agriculture at the University of Guelph. Dr. Mei-Wan Ho, director of the Institute of Science and Society in London, England. And Dr. David Suzuki, the chair of the David Suzuki Foundation, a geneticist, environmentalist, and broadcaster. A question period follows the main presentations. The moderator is Peter Tobbins of Greenpeace.
So our first speaker is Maud Barlow, political activist, author, policy critic, and chair of the Council of Canadians. Maud.
I'm absolutely thrilled to be here, and I thank you very, very much for this wonderful welcome. I love Vancouver. It's always, always like this. You always make me feel like there's hope out there. Very quickly, in this 20 minutes, I want to establish three things. The first is that global trade agreements at the bidding of the gene giants have locked in a global system that aggressively promotes GE foods and on behalf of their corporate producers. Secondly, that in Canada, this agenda is forced by corporations and the corporate sector working hand in hand with DFATE, the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, which I want to argue is now operating as a kind of government over the government we all think that we elected. And thirdly, that there's something we can do about all this. So as to the trade part of it, I just want to talk briefly about the World Trade Organization. It was designed basically originally to open up world markets to American exports and to remove the right of governments and citizens to maintain any kind of regulatory frameworks that might impede this goal. And of course, recently GMO foods and biotech products have moved to the very top of the agenda in the United States and of course in Canada. U.S. Deputy Treasury Secretary Stuart Eisenstadt told a U.S. Senate committee last year that, and I quote, almost 100% of our agricultural exports in the next 5 years will be genetically modified. The EU fear of bioengineered foods is the single greatest trade threat we fear. So they and others are using the WTO, and they've got at least three agreements that they enforce that have to do with genetically modified foods. The first is the Agreement on Sanitary and Phytosanitary Measures, SPS, which places a number of restrictions on domestic standards to protect human, plant, animal life, and health. Now, basically, it seeks to establish food regulations at the lowest common denominator by providing that governments provide airtight scientific proof that a product is not safe. It's the exact opposite of the precautionary proof that basically says, first, you do no harm. Clearly, of course, with industry controlling the so-called scientific studies, this proof is absolutely impossible. And I think it's really important to remind ourselves that in the last decade, there's been an exponential growth in new technologies, particularly in the biotechnology and chemical sectors. For example, of the 70,000 chemicals used for in commercial use in the United States, only 2% have been tested for human health effects. Tests on GMO and GMO-producing countries are almost non-existent, as they are considered by the WTO to be absolutely the same as or equivalent to non-GE engineered foods. So that's the first. The second is the Agreement on Technical Barriers to Trade, which is TBT, which is also used to force governments to roll back laws and policies that regulate GE foods, among other things. Rules and regulations must be what are called least trade restrictive, and even labeling of GMO foods is considered an impediment to the doctrine of free trade. In fact, the United States is using TBT to fight mandatory labeling around the world. And the third is TRIPS, the trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, which gives transnational biotech corporations legal rights to claim the patents of the genetic inheritance of the world, particularly the third world. By granting monopoly sales rights to patent holders for extended periods of time, the TRIPS agreement allows the gene giants to protect their own profit-making interests by making it more costly for poor and developing countries to procure seeds for crops and make medicines accessible to their people. Now, combined, these three agreements pose a sinister threat to the health and the well-being of the planet. While the TRIPS agreement requires that countries adopt very high standards for the protection of corporate property, the SPS and the TBT agreements force them to lower or eliminate their national standards for food, health, and environment protection. Diverse national standards designed to preserve local farms and biodiversity are replaced by uniform global standards designed to protect transnational corporate interests. And of course, this all gets locked in by an enforcement mechanism second to none in the world. The WTO, with its powerful enforcement mechanisms, then trumps other environmental and health and food safety agreements. While we know, of course, that we made some real progress in Montreal when the precautionary principle was adopted by the biosafety in the biosafety protocol, it's important to remember that the United States not only has not signed the biosafety protocol, but is maintaining that the World Trade Organization would take precedence in a dispute. So simply put, the WTO is the biotech industry's best friend. Don't think they don't know it. It was the global consortium of the industry led by the most powerful U.S. pharmaceutical and agribusiness corporations that led the fight for all three of these WTO agreements. And the big drug giants in the United States have given, it just has been published, that they have pulled out all the stops to keep Republicans in power in Congress and the Senate. And they spent an unprecedented $80 million to keep the Republicans in control of both houses. Bristol-Myers Squibb, Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson also set up a front group called Citizens for Better Medicare and launched ads featuring a woman named Flo, a perky elderly character who said she wanted to keep government out of my medicine cabinet. And this was an unprecedented amount of money spent in these ongoing elections. So that's the first thing I want to establish. The second thing is that how this gets translated in Canada is through the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, who, along with finance and to a lesser degree industry, acts as a kind of government that supersedes the government that continues to operate as if this other umbrella government doesn't exist. DFAT was created in 1993. By the Liberals when they first came to power. They merged foreign affairs and trade, and the budget for the trade section of it grew very, very quickly. For instance, in the last decade, the budget for the Trade Enhancement and Promotion Division of DFAT has more than doubled, while the budget for the entire Environment Department in the federal government has been cut in half. DFAT has power in several ways. One is that it goes off negotiating agreements that supersede and override what other departments think they are doing. I have a neighbor who works for DFAT, and it is his job, and he says it very clearly, to get up every morning and go out and liberalize trade. If they lose culture in one trade agreement, it's his job to find it a place for it in another. And he says, it's not any of my business, nor is it my mandate to look at its effect on health, environment, social programs, labor, whatever. We have one net mandate and one mandate alone. He's a nice guy. He's a nice father. He has a nice garden. But he does a bad thing every day with his life. And I think it's important to say that often these other departments simply don't know what's happening, and they're left to clean up. Witness Sheila Copps trying to put the best face on the magazine loss at the WTO when she swore it was never in danger. DFAT also vets, and this is very important, vets all other governmental departments and all provincial ministries, particularly in the areas of environment, food safety, health, and so on, for their compatibility with NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. We have many, many examples, including the five-year moratorium, the review of the 20-year patent drug law that was promised by the Liberals when they were in opposition. And after months of hearings and all-party parliamentary committee, they actually said this law is flawed. The then Health Minister, Dave Dingwall, said, thank you very much for your report. Thanks to all the thousands of people in the country who got involved, but sorry, NAFTA precludes us doing anything. The latest is a report by Clifford Lincoln, who is a backbencher in the Liberal government, who's very knowledgeable and committed environmentalist, who raised an issue that he believes and he has seen and hasn't got it in his hands. A letter from the current Trade Minister, Pierre Pettigrew, who has told his cabinet colleagues that they should not put the precautionary principle in any legislation because it might violate the WTO. Now, we know that letter exists, and we're trying to get it through access to information legislation. I'm stunned, you know, when I look at these people. Pierre Pettigrew actually wrote a book at one point talking about globalization and said one must never support trade agreements with no environmental or safety, social safety standards. Sergio Marchi, who was our trade minister and who is now the ambassador to the WTO, once called NAFTA, the FTA, and the GST a crown of thorns for the country. Both of them, of course, have now become leading cheerleaders, which all goes to prove my theory that those two are the first genetically engineered humans in the world. Although, I think that there are a number of politicians in other countries who've also been experimented on. So here's my theory. DFAT rules the Canadian government, and corporations rule DFAT. And this is very clearly established in the original big trade negotiations office that was set up by Simon Reisman way back in 1987 to negotiate the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement. Gordon Ritchie, in his recent book, Sleeping with the Elephant, absolutely openly describes how they brought the business community in as an equal partner and established them, along with government, as a bipolar negotiating team. I mean, there's not even an attempt to kind of be subtle about it. I thought maybe I'll find a hint in his book. No hint. There's page after page describing it. This has never changed. When Tony Clark received a copy of the MAI in a brown paper bag in early 1997, and for months the government of Canada had been telling us it didn't exist, obviously we found out it did. Well, through freedom of access or access to information documents that we got not long ago, we found that not only was the government lying and they knew about it, had been meeting with the corporate community when they were telling us it didn't exist, they were meeting with the corporate community, the Business Council on National Issues, and the Chambers of Commerce back in 1993. By the time we caught them, the deal was 90% finalized. So DFAT rules government, corporations rule government, and I want to pose that transnational corporate interests dominate the corporate interests and the businesses that dominate and rule DFAT. And so we have high-tech giants, for instance, through this mechanism and the enforcement of these trade agreements through DFAT in our country, having an absolute stranglehold on Canadian policy in GMO and other high-tech sectors. As it stands now, there is no political mechanism to take back control from DFAT and its current masters. So that's where we come in, and that's the third thing I want to talk about tonight, and that is what I think we have to do. I want to say that we have some fine people in politics. Some of them are here in this room tonight, and we're standing with you to get back in power. But it is very, very clear that we have a sick democracy. We have a sick system. And the most important changes in recent years has not come from our political institutions. We send good people in there and they either capitulate or they leave or they stay and fight, but they're always fighting something that they can't touch because it doesn't belong to them. And we have to say that the most important political changes in recent years have come from an informed, organized citizens movement with its own power base, its own analysis, its own research, its own public outreach capacity, its own alternatives, and its own demands. Gone are the days when we will politely beg governments to do the right thing by the people. That too. A Freudian slip that was a good slip. Gone are the days when we will politely beg governments to do the right thing by the people who they claim they serve. What we learned from the MAI fight, what we learned from Seattle and Washington and Windsor and Melbourne and Seoul and Prague is that they only listen to us if we are powerful. The leadership on this fight has come from the so-called third world, and I say so-called because many of our friends in the South believe that the very worst thing their countries could do would be adopt the values and ideology of the so-called first world. But I think it's very important for us to recognize that leadership on the GE side has come from places like the governments of Africa, who all together worked to block Canada and the U.S. and several other countries who tried to stop the precautionary principle from being inserted into the biosafety protocol. We know that in Asia, the Monsanto Quit India campaign, for example, was launched by an alliance of over 100 farmers and consumer groups. It was organized in the wake of months of protests by Indian farmers and consumers in a region where close to 500 farmers have committed suicide in response to failures associated mainly with BT cotton crops. There's some really good stories there. Responding to a legal petition filed by Vandana Shiva's organization, the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology, the Supreme Court of India ruled just months ago that all the field trials of Monsanto's BT cotton be halted. We know that wonderful work is taking place in Latin America. Mexico, Colombia, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, Brazil are all fighting on the ground on the GE front. We know, of course, that there's wonderful work being done in Europe, and we have people in this room who've been very involved in that campaign. The A-seed people, the fight against our hormone beef in this country, which Europe has had a good sense to turn back no matter what the WTO says. And of course, the work that's now beginning to be done in North America by the groups that are here in this country and, of course, in the United States. We know, for instance, that pressure from citizens groups in Maine caused Monsanto to withdraw its application to grow GE corn crops in the state, while on the other side of the country, biotech activists destroyed a test plot of Novartis BT corn on the University of California campus in Berkeley. 5 minutes, that's easy. Winding down here, like my friend Tony, I've been in Central America not very long ago, and my brain is shutting down. So I'm going to end with the following thoughts. There is a movement afoot. This is a movement whose time has come. In Canada, we are putting together a coalition. You see it here tonight. It's been instrumental in getting a number of food companies to go GE free. The council is sponsoring a Science in the Public Good conference in February in Ottawa. We have Ralph Nader as our keynote speaker, which we're very glad about. Go on to our website and find the information. We would love to have you there. We also have a wonderful water conference here, which is a little off topic. But anyway, water and GE foods are very similar, and that's going to be in early July here in Vancouver. Tony and I have just finished a new book called Global Showdown. Now, you see, I told Peter by 8 o'clock, which is now 1 o'clock my time, my brain would start to wind down. So I've got 3 minutes for the wind down. But it's about the civil society movement, and I just want to end with some thoughts about what we're trying to articulate, which is that we think that a new movement has been born. It has many, many parents from the environment and from the food security fight and from labor, of course, and the women's movement and the human rights movement and all of the wonderful work that so many people have done against the World Bank and so on. But something new has come together, and I just want to end by describing what I think its major characteristics are, what we really believe. It's the most important is that we believe that it's not enough to tinker around with these institutions at a global level. Something much more profound and fundamental has to change, mostly our relationship to nature and a profound shift in wealth and power. We believe that we have to start living within natural ecosystems again and grow and make more food and goods closer to home. We are not opposed to trade, but we dispute its ascendancy and overarching power in every sphere of life. We want to take back under public democratic control the commons we believe have been stolen from people and nature. We believe in cultural and biological diversity and respect and defend the infinite variety of the natural world, including other species. We share the notion that one of the most potent antidotes to economic globalization is the return to community and some form of democracy closer to home. We believe that the economy exists to serve people and communities, not the other way around. At the same time, our movement, which we have started calling the New Democracy Movement, is international in scope. Community can mean friends halfway around the world and recognizes common interests in our common struggle. While cherishing diversity, a core value of our movement, we are also multi-issue. Even when activists continue to focus on particular issues that brought them into the movement, they make connections to the whole and reflect a broader perspective. Oh, this is easy. I'm down to half a minute. What is really at stake and what we all deeply believe in is the need for civic culture to prevail over corporate culture. As Ralph Nader says, you can have democracy or you can have corporate rule. You cannot have both. So I would end by saying, first of all, you've got in this room and on this stage some very brave people you want to support and we want to thank. We all need to make a commitment this night that we are going to win this fight. And I'd end with the words that either democracy and the survival of the planet matter or they do not. Decide one more time. Thank you very much.
That was Maud Barlow, democracy activist.
Wow. Okay. Our next speaker, Anne Clark, associate professor in the Plant Agriculture Department, the University of Guelph, and a charming dinner companion.
Thank you very much. Now, I want to use the example of Starlink corn to make the point that GM crops have been released prematurely into the marketplace, forcing consumers in every other sector of the food and agriculture chain to absorb costs which should rightly belong to the purveyors of the technology. These involuntary costs are being absorbed unwillingly by people that don't know what's happening to them. It's just being forced on them involuntarily. It's being forced on you, and you don't even know about it yet, but you will after tonight. Externalizing these costs of production onto other people makes the technology look more profitable than it actually is. So it's important to keep this in mind when you're deciding if there's a place for GM in your future or not. Now, this patently unfair distribution of costs and benefits, what we might call the socialization of costs and the privatization of benefits, has been starkly revealed by the Starlink debacle. Starlink is a particular kind of corn, particular kind of BT corn, and it makes a very interesting story in and of itself. But why I'm bringing it up tonight, because most of you are probably not farmers, so you don't have to deal with it, but it's a very good, clear predictor of what the future holds when second wave GM technology hits the marketplace, understanding that first wave GM technology is predominantly agronomic characteristics, things like herbicide-tolerant crops and BT crops. Those are things that happen on the farm, and they haven't really come home to you yet as they have to farmers. What makes this particular corn different is that for the first time, it has the potential to impact human health. And so it brings GM onto the radar of consumers in a way that hasn't happened before. And I want to really stress this point to you tonight. Now, what is Starlink? Starlink is a type of BT corn. There are about 15 of them that have been approved in Canada. This particular BT corn has not been approved in Canada. It was approved in the US, but what makes it different is it's a new type of BT, and the protein that's coded for by this new type of BT has properties characteristic of known allergens. Now understand that when they do testing for allergenicity in genetically engineered crops, they don't actually test allergenicity. They have indirect measures that they use in the laboratory, and based on those measures, they have concluded that everything already in the marketplace is safe. But along comes this one, and the particular protein is called Cry9C, and it has all of the properties of known allergens. So the U.S. government decided to approve it only for livestock feed, not for human consumption. It's the only one like that. Now, so what this does then essentially is it puts it into your ballpark. And why this is so important is consumers are a far more powerful lobby group than farmers. And you should be employing that power. Now, what is the problem with Starlink corn? Because it is approved only for livestock feed, it has to be kept segregated from conventional grain. Understand that corn grain is used for ethanol, it's used for human consumption, corn flakes, tortillas, and so on, and for livestock feed. Those are the three primary uses. Well, along comes this corn that somehow has to be kept segregated from all the rest of the corn. And that's the problem. It starts on the farm. Farmers, in order to grow this crop, were supposed to keep this stuff isolated, reproductively isolated. And the point is that corn is an outcrossing species. That means pollen moves. And this is the same with other crops like canola or cotton or potatoes. Pollen moves. And the expected distance is about 200 meters for corn. This is the agreed upon distance that they had to keep in non-corn crops around Starlink to make sure that the pollen didn't go and inadvertently pollinate and spread these Starlink genes, these potentially allergenic traits, into other corn. So each farmer, and keep in mind there were between 2 and 3,000 farmers who grew this in the year 2000 in the US, each one of those farmers was supposed to have a 200 meter border around every field of Starlink corn. Then every elevator operator that received this corn had to somehow segregate it so that it didn't get into the bulk stream. There were 260 elevators that received this. So just to recap, that's 2,000 to 3,000 farmers and 260 elevator operators, each of whom had to independently make decisions and implement them in their own operations to segregate this crop and keep it out of the human food chain. But what actually happened is that most of the farmers and elevators reportedly were not advised of the unique characteristics of Starlink and went ahead and grew it along like every other GM crop and marketed it into the marketplace. And by the time this was discovered this fall, some 9 million bushels of Starlink or Starlink contaminated corn had made its way into conventional channels, some of which included the human food chain. Now, I want to go through some of the externalized costs that this has caused on this particular case, Starlink, and I relate it to what is coming down the pike at you when second wave technology hits the market. Now, second wave, just so you know what I mean, is things like industrial enzymes, nutraceuticals, pharmaceuticals, vaccines, plastics. Did you know that they're engineering crops to produce all of these things? And many of the crops that they're engineering them into are outcrossing species, just like corn. Okay, so what are the costs? Farmers, in the first case, have to isolate on their farm. They have to make decisions. They have to plan it so that the stuff can't cross, supposedly. Then when it comes time to harvest it, they have to clean out their combine, which takes hours, clean out all of their equipment, the trailers, the tractors, anything that has been in contact with that crop so that it will not carry over into the next load of grain from another field that they're taking. So farmers have to absorb all of these costs in order to grow Starlink corn, in this case, or any second wave crop as well. Secondly, elevators now have to test every load of corn that comes in. There are thousands of loads every day. Every one of them has to be tested before the load can be dumped to decide if it is Starlink contaminated or not. It's expensive, it's time consuming, it slows down the process, but it has to be done because huge silos, huge grain silos can be completely eliminated as a crop. 5 minutes?
No.
Oh, good. Don't move. Don't move. Hold still. Jeez. processors have to, and so elevators have to absorb these costs. They're going to pass it on, of course. Processors have to do the same thing because they can't risk receiving contaminated grain and having it turned into a product which then they have to recall. So at every step along the way, they have to absorb these test costs. And I should indicate that the processing and marketing industry has made it quite clear that they are not about to take a bullet for the seed trade. So this is putting a very interesting wrinkle in what had been a very seamless relationship between the seed trade and other partners in the food industry. Thirdly, as a result of the Starlink problem, whole chains of restaurants and grocery stores have had to destock their shelves. 2.5 million boxes of just one kind of tortilla shell had to be pulled off the shelves, put back in boxes, and shipped back to the supplier. There's 7,000 Taco Bells. Did you know there were 7,000 Taco Bells? There are. They had to all collect up all that stuff and ship it back without unduly alarming their customers. The fourth level of additional costs, and of course, this costs money. This costs time to do all this. The fourth level is the seed trade itself. Aventis is the company that is responsible for this particular type of corn. They have agreed voluntarily, reportedly, to buy back all of this contaminated stuff, both from the sown fields and from the 200-meter borders all around the sown fields. Current estimates of the cost of that are between $100 million and $1 billion. And this is just for the year 2000 crop. Fifth level is government and ultimately taxpayers has to pay for monitoring this whole thing, regulating it, dealing with irate international customers who don't want to buy our product anymore, loss of prestige, and all the rest of that. At every level along the way, costs are being added on. Now, what about functional foods? I want to make the point that this example of Starlink gives us a very rare and special opportunity to see the future, to see what is going to happen, and to see that far from making food cheaper, as you have been promised, It has got to make it more expensive because every step along the way is going to have new costs built into the value of food. This ongoing Starlink debacle, and it is still ongoing, we haven't got to lawsuits yet, many of which have already been filed. People are already claiming that their health has been impacted, that they are in fact allergic to Cry9C. There's all sorts of levels of retail, seed trade, people at every level who are trying to recover those costs that they've had to expend on behalf of Aventis. But the Starlink debacle basically proved two fundamental truths. One is that pollen moves. It's an expensive way to learn it, but they learned that. And secondly, people make mistakes. They learned that too. All understand that this entire mess came from 0.5% of all of the corn land planted in the U.S. in that year. One crop type on 0.5% of the land is costing all of this expense at every level of the entire food system. Now imagine that you have dozens of these crops, hundreds of these crops, which is what we're being promised, and they are in outcrossing species, as they are. How can you pretend to even begin to think that you are going to be able to reproductively isolate those crops when it's not 3,000 farmers, but 300,000 farmers independently making decisions, taking responsibility for establishing these isolation zones, thoroughly cleansing their combine after they harvest it, all of those hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of elevators that are going to be receiving not one off type, but many types of GM crop. It boggles the mind. You're going to wind up with vaccines in your cornflakes, plastic in God knows what. It's just unimaginable to me how this can be done any way that is in any respect consistent with commercial agriculture, field-scale agriculture. So, in closing,
you actually have 5 minutes.
In closing, I've tried to give you some reasons to think that this technology, which we are very fortunate to have the Starlink example to give us a glimpse of this, this technology is fundamentally incompatible with field-scale agriculture. It simply can't be done. And how they can pretend otherwise, I don't know. My great fear is that this, at least 1/2 of this problem, will be dealt with by one very easy solution. Anybody guess? No, the way that they're going to suggest that they simply have to solve this problem. Terminator. If you have Terminator, then you don't worry about the first half of the problem. Now, you still have the problem of getting it all into the right bins at the right time and the rest of it, but that is the entire purpose of Terminator. I very often believe that they fully expected to have Terminator not only on the market, but in these crops before they go into the field in the first place. And that opportunity has been short-circuited, at least for the short fall. If you don't know, there are 17 different patents out for Terminator-type technologies. It's not just Monsanto. Novartis has 7 of them, I believe. They're all in waiting. And this is a real good justification, what happened with Starlink, for why they simply must have Terminator. So give that some thought. If you don't know as well, Terminator is just one example of the so-called traitor technologies. That is to say, disabling technologies. We tend to think of genetic engineering as adding traits, adding disease resistance, adding herbicide tolerance, adding a particular industrial enzyme production capability. But there's a whole bunch of patents already granted for disabling disabling germination, that's what Terminator does. There are others for disabling disease resistance, disabling any one of a number of normal life traits. So this is the whole dark side of genetic engineering, which you may not be aware of, but this is what is awaiting farmers in the future. So, in closing, I want you to think, is this technology ready for prime time? Is this a technology that will ever be ready to be released? And I would suggest to you that it's premature for it to have been in the marketplace now, and it will always be incompatible with agriculture so long as pollen moves and people make mistakes. Thank you.
That was Dr. Ann Clark of the University of Guelph. You're listening to a panel on biotechnology, Big Money, Bad Science, recorded November 10th in Vancouver, Canada.
Another good one, and the right attitude towards the moderator. Our next speaker, Maewon Ho, director of the Institute of Science and Society based in London, England. Maewon Ho.
Thank you very much. This is a very pleasant first visit to Vancouver to see all of you here. Well, just before I left Britain, we had these newspaper headlines which says, Britain might be mistaken for a third world country. Why? We had chaos on the railway, protests over fuel price increase in the midst of the worst storms and floods in decades. And a CJD epidemic that is that may claim up to tens of thousands of lives. The public inquiry report on mad cow disease, published at the end of October, blames persistent government denials over the link between CJD and BSE beef, based on what they claim was the best scientific advice. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? And this advice was given by the Southwood Committee in 1989, and it said it was most unlikely that BSE will have any implications for human health. So I'm sure you heard something like that about GMOs. Well, the scientific establishment had failed to acknowledge that science is always incomplete and uncertain, and to insist on the precautionary approach. The precautionary approach might also have averted global warming had it been adopted 10, 20 years earlier. And it is high time we adopt it now in genetic engineering. And if we can learn anything at all from climate change and CJD fiasco, it is that science is too important to be left to the politicians or to a scientific establishment increasingly in bed with big business. Our academic institutions have given up all pretense of being citadels of higher learning, certainly the case in the UK, and I gather you have a better one in Canada. They've given up the idea that they are disinterested, they are places where you can have disinterested inquiry into the nature of things, and least of all, that they are guardians of the public good. The corporatization of science is the greatest threat to the survival of our planet, to our own survival as well, and to the survival of the planet. And it works in subtler ways than generally recognized. Western science dominates the world through its technologies, many of which become instruments of destruction and exploitation in the hands of corporate business. More significant, however, is the mechanistic mindset of the science through which the world is perceived and then shaped. It presents nature as isolated atoms at every level, jostling and competing against one another in the Darwinian struggle for the survival of the fittest. And organisms are mistaken for machines, and there is no limit to how they can be manipulated for profit, especially by changing their genes. So genes and genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, have become the latest, hottest commodities. The mechanistic mindset is all of a piece, by the way, with the neoliberal economic theory promoting globalization, which you heard from Maud, the removal of all international barriers to trade, investment, and finance that has enabled corporations to ruthlessly exploit human beings and destroy our planet in their quest for maximum profit. The result is a total social, economic, an ecological crisis on a global scale. And that was why we had 50,000 in the streets in Seattle, and a further 20,000 in Prague. And it will go on until people's aspiration for a safe, just, equitable, sustainable, and compassionate world is heeded. The mechanistic paradigm has failed us in life. It has also failed within science. Contemporary Western science across the disciplines has been rediscovering how nature is organic, dynamic, and interconnected. There are no linear causal chains linking the genes to the characteristics of organisms, let alone the human condition. Genes work in complex entangled networks, constantly responding to feedback from the internal and external environment. The techniques for manipulating the genetic material in organisms, which gave birth to genetic engineering 25 years ago, also enabled the geneticists to look at, to study the genetic material in ways that were not possible before. And the findings have turned genetics upside down. By the 1980s, geneticists have coined the phrase the fluid genome to describe how dynamic the genetic material is in all organisms, which is subject to both small and large changes in the course of development, as well as in response to feedback from the environment. The new genetics is radically holistic and ecological, as is life itself. But the old discredited paradigm is still being perpetrated by our academic institutions in exactly the way that neoliberal economics still dominates the political mainstream, if only because it serves so well to promote gene biotechnology and to make unethical uses seem compelling. The Human Genome Project to map the genetic material of our species has been hyped a great deal. But the only concrete offers thus far are patented gene tests. There are some 740 of it already available in the market. And in cases where such tests can help to diagnose and treat patients, exorbitant license fees have prevented them from being used. On the other hand, healthy people testing positive are denied employment and health insurance. Among the human genes and cell lines patented and sold by corporations are those stolen, as we heard this morning, from indigenous tribes under the pretext of providing medical care or even under coercion. Prenatal and pre-implantation diagnoses are eliminating human fetuses and embryos carrying genes said to predispose them to cancers as adults. And Jim Watson, co-winner of the Nobel Prize for the structure of DNA, the genetic material, even suggested that parents might want to eliminate the unborn carrying homosexuality genes. There are no such genes, by the way. The overwhelming causes of ill health are environmental and social. The World Health Organization has long ago concluded that at least 80% of all cancer is attributable to environmental factors. Hundreds of actual and potential carcinogens have been identified among the 70,000 industrial chemicals that pollute our air, water, and soil. Rising epidemics of childhood cancers are linked to mutations caused by radioactive wastes seeping from processing plants or dumped into the sea and washed up on our beaches. But the cancer research establishment is doing little for cancer prevention except identifying putative genes predisposing people to cancer. The focus on genes is misplaced. It is diverting attention and resources away from the real causes of ill health, allowing the culprits to continue to pollute our life support system with impunity and to profit from the rising tide of ill health, the so-called health market. And a headline in the financial pages of a recent Guardian says it all. Gene hunters say patients are a bankable asset. Worse yet, the genetic mantle placed on diseases and other human conditions end up blaming the victims, fueling the reemergence of genetic discrimination and eugenics that have blighted the history of much of the last century, and this century as well, really. A prominent band of scientists and bioethicists are advocating germline gene therapy, as you heard this morning, which amounts to creating genetically modified human beings. They see the creation of a gene-rich class of human beings to be inevitable, as those that can afford to will pay to genetically enhance their offsprings, and consequently there will be a genetic underclass, children of those people who can't afford to pay, that might become a separate inferior species. Human embryos are cultivated in the laboratory to provide cells and tissues for transplants. International trafficking of human organs is already rife, and eggs and embryos will be added to the list. In the Indian Seed Tribunal in September, three farmers in the same family told the tribunal how they had to sell their kidneys when their crops failed from the bad seeds they were sold. Now, they were the responsible ones because the other farmers just committed suicide instead. In future, the women may well be forced into selling their embryos and eggs. Last year, the first human clone was created by transferring the genetic material of a human cell into a cow's egg. In October this year, researchers transplanted another one, it made another human, so-called human clone, by transferring the human genetic material into the egg of a pig. Mercifully, the experiments were destroyed at 14 days, which is the current legal limit. Otherwise, we would have been faced with Frankenstein. At least the original Dr. Frankenstein didn't do it for money. And that is the bottom line. In deciding whether any application is ethical or beneficial, we have to ask whether this would be done, it would be done if there were no money to be made. And who can benefit when all the genes, cell lines, and reproductive processes are patented for commercial exploitation? So gene biotechnology is not just about GM food or GM human beings, it's a commitment to an existential nightmare, a descent into a self-made hell on Earth. And Mary Shelley's brilliant novel was not only a parable about this arrogant scientist playing God, it is about mechanistic science out of control in the service of the corporate empire. In China, where my family originates, rice, pronounced fan, means livelihood. It means contentment and self-sufficiency. In Thailand, rice is life, and the Karen Hill tribes are so intimately connected to rice that the rice spirit is brought back to the people and the land in a rice ceremony every year. Tens of thousands of rice varieties still exist in Thailand, which have been collected, created, and propagated by the farmers in the course of thousands, if not tens of thousands of years. That despite the fact that a U.S. scientist, Dr. Love, absconded with 1,200,000 varieties collected, 120,000 varieties collected for the Thai Gene Bank in the 1950s. Thai rice varieties come in endless shades of gold, red, and black, each with a distinctive fragrance, serving different purposes and occasions to enhance life as much as to provide nutrition. Each variety is valued and loved for its own sake, more than a connoisseur might appreciate varieties of tea, coffee, or wine. I was given a bag of red rice to take home to London and have savored every mouthful since. Seeds are freely given and exchanged as gifts among the farmers in Thailand, as they are all over Asia, Latin America, and Africa, to people whose lives are so intricately interwoven with their indigenous plant varieties, what else can GM crops be but an abomination? And why should the rest of us not recover to some extent this aesthetic and spiritual connection to our food? There is little doubt that GM crops will further destroy livelihood and self-sufficiency through corporate patents on seeds that the farmers cannot resow or exchange, and through GM terminator seeds, as we heard, that render them sterile, breaking the very cycle of renewal and regeneration that is the essence of life. GM is also an untried, inadequately researched technology. There is no evidence whatsoever that GM crops are safe, of the kind that would stand up in a court of law or to close scientific scrutiny, despite what our regulators and their chosen scientists are saying. And the parallel to BSE is far too close for comfort. The UK government tried to place Aventis Chardon LL GM corn, and this is the same company of Starling fame, on the national list, but overwhelming objection from the public forced a public hearing, which is still going on. And hundreds of people went and gave scientific evidence of harm. And Aventis' only evidence is an unpublished report, almost, submitted to the hearing, showing, actually, that there were twice as many deaths in chickens fed the GM corn compared to those fed non-GM corn, and our regulators accepted that as evidence for safety. Anyway, now the evidence of hazards, much of it in the scientific literature, is stronger than ever before. Okay, which is why more than 370 scientists from 43 countries, including Anne and Suzuki here, very famous people, have signed this letter to all governments calling for a global moratorium as well as a ban on patents of living organisms and living processes. And the hazards are inherent to the uncontrollable, unpredictable nature of the genetic modifying process itself. I will just take a few minutes to explain that to you because I think it's very important. First, GM involves making new genes and new combinations of genes in the laboratory that are transferred into cells and embryos to create these genetically modified organisms. And none of these may ever have existed in billions of years of evolution. The GM genetic material are typically from dangerous bacteria, viruses, and other genetic parasites that cause diseases, and include antibiotic resistance genes that make infectious diseases untreatable. The gene products encoded by the genes may be harmful, as we have heard already, as they have never been part of our food chain, and they are also new to the ecosystem. GM constructs are designed to cross species barriers and to invade genomes, but the genetic engineer cannot control where and in what form the GM constructs end up in the genome. Unexpected toxins and allergens turn up. And this has been found, by the way, in Monsanto's Roundup GM soya. Apparently, if you look at their own paper carefully, you find that it increased milk fat in cows and decreased weight gain in male rats. It has unexpected 27% increase in alpha antitrypsin, a major allergen and growth inhibitor, as well as an unreported, this is data that they kept hidden, which came to light later, it had 100% increase in another soya lectin, which is another allergen, again unexpected. Now, GM constructs are unstable as well as the GM lines. In fact, there are no data whatsoever documenting the genetic stability of any GM line that's already out there. The GM constructs are often scrambled up when inserted into the genome. In later generations of the GMO created, the GM construct may get scrambled further, become silenced, or, more worrying, lost altogether. Then you ask, where does it go? Not only does it seriously compromise the agronomic performance, but these GM genes can actually spread, not just by cross-pollination to related species, but by something called horizontal gene transfer to unrelated species. So even if you have terminated genes, these can also spread by horizontal gene transfer. And then, of course, what is more worrying is spreading antibiotic resistance genes, creating new viruses and bacterial pathogens, and triggering cancer in animals. Now, what I want to say is there's plenty of evidence, which I don't have time to read out to you, and it's all published in the very respectable scientific literature. What I want to say in closing, there's plenty of evidence to the on the contrary that low-input ecological farming methods using crops and knowledge adapted to local conditions have been increasing yields 2-3-fold or more in Latin America, Africa, and Asia since the 1980s, providing social, environmental, and health benefits besides. There are compelling reasons for farmers to grow and sell locally crops adapted to local conditions rather than national or international varieties for export. Export industrial agriculture is responsible for a great proportion of the fossil fuel consumption that contributes to the present global climate change. There is also incalculable health bonus to be gained by phasing out all agrochemicals already known to be linked to cancers and many other illnesses. In short, now is the time for all of us to join forces to turn the tide on bad science and big business, to reclaim the good life in every sense for everyone. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Mei Wan Ho of ISIS. This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. You're listening to a panel on biotechnology, Big Money, Bad Science, recorded November 10th in Vancouver, Canada.